Hey folks, thank you for checking out this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you want to learn more about this project, you can go to the website lastbornthewilderness.com. A link to that website is in the description. And on the website, you'll find every episode I've produced, every segment that's been released from those episodes. You'll find every platform this podcast is streaming from that you can subscribe to this podcast on. And you'll find other social media platforms that you can follow this project on as well. So if you want to support this thing, though, you know, this podcast is a work of passion. It's something I do just on my free time. Actually, more than just my free time. I think more and more of my time has been allocated to researching and preparing for interviews and setting up interviews and releasing episodes and the whole process that goes into that. So it's become something like, I mean, I put a lot of my love and time into this project. Anybody willing to contribute to that, I'm very grateful to. There's a link to the donation page if you want to send a one-time donation through the PayPal link. There's also a link to the Patreon page if you want to go to patreon.com/lastbornthewilderness. There you can make very small monthly contributions to the production of this project. And to those that are already patrons, I want to thank you again, as I will continue to do. Just thank you for doing that, because, I mean, you don't have to do that. And it means a lot to me that people are willing to do anything like that for somebody who is just, I don't know, interviewing people and stuff like that. So I don't know. I am very thankful to you. And one last thing I want to say is that two weeks ago at this point, I guess it's been, of the release of this episode, maybe, yeah, 2 weeks since the release of the live podcast, the video live recording of the live podcast with Dar Jamail and Dr. Bones. That just came out not very long ago, and you can watch both parts of that on YouTube. You can also just listen to them here in the episodes listing. They're episode 154 of the podcast. So please check those out. It was a really interesting experience for each guest I interviewed. I did that in front of a live audience, and there were questions and answer sessions after each interview. So people that were participating through the live stream of the event and people that were there in person could ask Dar Jamail about climate change, about abrupt climate disruption, and what's going on with that. And then we got into Dr. Bones, and people were asking him about, you know, mutual aid and resistance and how to set up cellular networks and some really interesting stuff like that. So I really greatly enjoyed that experience. I hope I can do it again. And yeah, so please check out all the links that I just mentioned in this introduction here. And thank you for your attention up to this point. Here's the episode. In this episode, I speak with Mina Wabisabi. Mina is the co-editor of Gods and Radicals and writes about decoloniality, feminism, and anti-capitalism. And the reason why I wanted to speak with Mina, besides the fact that she is a part of Gods and Radicals, writes for Gods and Radicals, is part of the, you know, she's a site co-manager, I think, at this point, and I think she's going to be taking on full site management of Gods and Radicals. So she's, you know, become a huge part of the project, and just on that alone, I've always, like, been wanting to speak with her for some time, but especially more recently because of the election of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. Mina is a Brazilian woman. She's somebody who is from Brazil, has lived in Brazil from what I can understand most of her life. She lives there currently. She is an anarchist. She is an anti-capitalist. And a far-right populist neo-fascist was just elected. And so we discuss this very frightening moment for the people of Brazil and the indigenous populations of Brazil, too, is what we get into, is how Brazil has massive rainforests. The indigenous populations that occupy much of this, you know, they're detrimentally affected by this election because Bolsonaro in particular wants to sell off more land than already has to miners, to agro-business, to people that are going to basically clear-cut this forest and continue the process of deforestation at even more rapid pace than it already is. And that's something we also talk a bit about, is how in an article that she had written, which really what actually sparked this whole thing, in that piece she writes about, you know, the what she kind of expects to come out of this election, and then the results come in, and she is very nervous for understandable reasons why. It's like when Trump was elected, but way worse, because the things that he is advocating for are so much more on-the-nose fascist and, you know, very much a dictatorship that he is trying to create out of his administration, right? It's very worrisome. And so in this discussion, we talk about voting, the value of voting, because Mina is an anarchist. She doesn't really believe that voting is really going to create the change that is required for us to become free. But it's interesting talking about voting in the face of this election, right? Because I remember just this past midterm election, I received a lot of pressure to vote, and I didn't feel comfortable doing it, regardless of how, quote, important or you know, this is the election of our lifetimes. They say that every fucking time. This is just a really great conversation that covers so many different topics. It was very conversational. Mina is a very good person to speak with. I felt immediately comfortable speaking with her about all of these things. She is very deeply empathetic, intelligent, fierce human being. I just kind of get this through speaking with her. So I really enjoyed speaking about this subject with her, and I really ask that people go and check her out on Gods and Radicals. She does an amazing job with that website, but her writing in particular is very good, and I recommend reading that. I'll provide a link to her writings down in the description, also a link to her Twitter, and like I said, she's a part of running Gods and Radicals, so please go and follow Gods and Radicals. I can't promote their work enough. It's just such a great project, and I'm so happy to see that it exists. So I have nothing else really to add to this, except that this is a really moving conversation, and I thank Mina for having it with me. Thank you all for your attention. Here's the episode with Mina Wabi Sabi. But yeah, no, I appreciate you for talking with me, and I've just been really concerned about this election in Brazil. And actually, I guess we'll just start this now, but this whole thing about voting and what, you know, whether if you're a hardline leftist or anarchist or somebody who believes that voting kind of like you're participating in a program or a system that is fundamentally illegitimate and deserving to be destroyed in some capacity. And that fine line between having that stance but also recognizing that voting can be a strategic act, without having any illusions about what it really is. You know, here in the U.S., like, we have it's a midterm election. So, like, in the state that I live in Idaho, they're voting for a new governor. There's actually her name is Paulette Jordan, and she is a indigenous woman here in Idaho. She's the first person, I think, in the United States as an indigenous person to, I think, run for governor in any state. And, you know, by all standards, she's considered very progressive, especially for where I live. And there's also a few things on the ballot that I think maybe will have an effect in people's immediate life. So I've always been kind of conflicted, because I've always been like, we need to do more to advocate for our political action, and political lives don't begin and end in a voting booth. But the conflict of knowing that that really, yeah, you know, little decisions like this actually can have a direct impact on people's lives. And considering that you are in Brazil, and that this man, Bolsonaro. Yeah, he was recently elected as president. And, you know, the whole argument is like, well,
if you would have gone and voted, maybe someone like him wouldn't have been in power and we could still save people's lives. I guess to ask what your political position is on this subject, considering the state of things in Brazil.
Yeah, first of all, we here avoid saying his name or writing because they're trying to, they keep track of how many times he's mentioned and they kind of calculate how relevant he is as a figure that way. So now we say a lot like hashtag not him or the, it's hard to translate, ukoizu, the stuff, the dude, but in a object type. So we don't even like saying his name. It's a bit tense.
Yeah.
I didn't vote, I'm going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I did not vote. And this is very controversial. I've had people really upset with me in some way, saying like it's because of people like me that this happened, because apparently there were 30, so it was a margin of 10% that he won, and 30 people did not vote, which means 30% of people did not vote, which means everyone who just didn't show up to the ballot, people who voted blank or people who voted no. We have these two different options. Blank means that your vote goes to the person who's winning. No, you're just not computed. You're not part of the, you're just not counted as a percentage. So a lot of people are really upset about this. The problem is that this 30% that didn't vote, they're not necessarily all for, against Bolsonaro. They're not necessarily people like me. And many of them are just people who couldn't, just the bureaucracy of voting here. A lot of people just couldn't. They wanted to, they couldn't. We have this thing here that's really bizarre. We are required to vote. You have to pay a fine if you don't vote. I'm going to pay a fine for not going to the ballot. So we are required to vote, but at the same time, they make it very difficult for you to actually go vote. You need to have... there's this debate in the United States, right? The voter ID thing. Mm-hmm. But here is, if that is a problem for you guys, you have no idea what we have to go through, because we need to have not just an ID, we need to have a special card and we need to be registered a certain place. We can't vote anywhere. So over 6 months before elections, you need to change your location of voting. So you need to know where you're going to be 6 months in advance. For a lot of people, this is fine, but there's a whole bureaucracy to change location of your vote. So a lot of people need to go back to their hometown if they're not there, if they're traveling for work or anything. So a lot of people actually that I know have to go all the way, if they have the means to go back to their hometown to vote because they can't change the location of their voting place. So a lot of those people just couldn't. I, for example, even if I wanted to vote, I couldn't. Because I'm registering in the Netherlands.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And I registered there because, yeah, it's like, and I can't fly to the Netherlands to vote.
Mm.
Because I registered in the first round when Dilma was like, I voted no in the first round, and the second round I voted Dilma, which was a similar situation. And she ended up getting impeached. So,
mm-hmm.
So much for my vote.
Yeah.
So it's a problem here, definitely, this discussion. I'm not against people who vote. I think it's fine. And the Not Him campaign was fantastic because it united the left. It definitely united people against him. But like I wrote in that article you read, I guess.
Yes.
That even if Haddad won and nothing changed, we still have a problem, you know? So Right. That's why I don't vote. For me, my work is my work, no matter who wins and who loses. Mm-hmm. And of course, the context will change. There will be definitely some different obstacles, new and different obstacles. But there are always going to be obstacles. And I just adapt to the change and I continue to resist with whatever the result.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that the political situation, of course, in Brazil versus the United States, there may be similarities, but there's a lot of major differences as well. And trying to kind of project my own point of view my own politics on the situation of the people of Brazil or in any other part of the world that exists within a nation state, trying to project my values onto other people and say that this is the only way you can, you know, engage in political action, I think is pretty arrogant on my part. But I also recognize that the nature of a sort of representative democracy that is inherently capitalist, that's in Brazil, that's in the United States, and that's in pretty much every country or many countries around the world. A lot of the same dynamics seem to appear. And so when someone like this man who was elected just recently in Brazil, my feeling has been that I can almost relate, because I remember when Trump was elected here and everybody was a bit shocked that that was even possible. But this gentleman, I won't call him a gentleman, excuse me, this individual, that was me trying to be polite, but I shouldn't be
this
polite.
Individual, yeah.
This individual.
The individual, we'll call him that.
The individual, yes. He has been very open in his hatred towards minorities, towards indigenous people, towards women, towards anybody, or you know, leftists, people he is called the communists, right? Kind of, I think, pretty blankly, kind of a Cold War mentality, like the communist front, they're trying to take over the country, we need to eradicate them. His while Trump was still, it is very violent in his rhetoric, this individual who won in Brazil, he was much more forward from the very beginning about his intentions. And I just want to read what you did write in your piece, because you had written something in God's Radicals, the day of the election in Brazil, and then you had a little update after the results came in and showed who won.
Yeah.
But I just want to read that because I think it's interesting. It says, you said, people are so stressed that even anarchists are talking about voting and doing the lesser evil thing. But what will voting actually do? And you say you have some scenarios in mind. So JB wins, and he actually does all the absurd things he claimed he wanted to do. This is less likely because, let's be honest, when does a candidate actually follow through on a promise? Kill poor people, don't allow an inch of land to indigenous and Quilombist people, completely neglect public education and affirmative action, condone hate crimes, militarize whenever necessary, and so on. In this scenario, he would simply be the irrigation of the already existing and thriving crop. And then you go on to some other scenarios, but you know, something I think that you really pointed to in that essay is that all of these things that he's talking about are already happening in some capacity in Brazil. And when I read this article that came up yesterday, it was in The Guardian, and it was about how JB, I guess we could say his name, JB, his attitude towards indigenous people and the lands of the indigenous populations in Brazil, he has no respect for that and wants to completely hand that over to agribusiness and whatever other operates, mining, logging, all of that. But that seems to already be happening anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'll just ask you to please comment on what the current state of things are in Brazil and what this this individual who's elected, what his real attitude or behavior is going to be like when he's in power.
We really don't know. The uncertainty is widespread and people are really anxious. I think there's even an article now about like how these elections affected mental health in Brazil. People are really stressed out. I gotta say, the day I was a bit numbed out. I cried. My friends cried. We were afraid of getting out of the streets. There was already a physical attack the day of the elections here in the city where I live against a woman who was knocked out by the military police. So there's a lot of anxiety about physical violence on the streets. I'm sensitive. I hope I don't end up crying at some point in our conversation. But yesterday I was at a conference, like a round table discussion with Sonia Guajajara. She was the vice presidential candidate together with Boulos for the most progressive party we have here, PSOL. Not sure if you've heard of it. They are very progressive. I mean, of course, it's a political party, so as progressive a political party can get, I guess. Bolos talked about occupations. He talked about how a lot, repeatedly, about how there are more empty houses than homeless people, and he wanted to combat that. Sonia Guajajara is this indigenous woman, very powerful, very articulate, funny. Like, people in my circles, I mean, if we want someone in power, it's someone like her, you know? And yesterday she was really funny because she said exactly this. Like, for the first time ever, we're actually terrified a politician might actually follow through with their promise. This is, at this point, we're just like kind of hoping he's just, even people who voted for the man, for this elected man, actually said that they don't think he really thinks all the stuff he says. He just says da boca pra fora, they say. They just like kind of blowing up smoke, right? It's an expression. All the homophobia he says, he's just saying it. He doesn't mean it. He's an old-fashioned man from the 1950s. It's like, really, people are talking about, you know, walking backwards in time with pride, you know, like walking backwards, literally. But will he actually follow through with this? I mean, it would be easy for him to just not grant any more land for indigenous peoples. And what she said yesterday, along with like a table of really amazing indigenous and Quilombo leaders, was every election is a fight for them. Like, every election is a new set of problems and a new set of fights. They've always endured fascism. This is not the first time. Fascism didn't, you know, come to be now. So they deal with fascism always, for decades, for centuries, actually, literally for centuries. They talk about their struggle for 500 years. So now that we on the left kind of woke up to the fact that, yes, now we can't ignore the fact that it is fascism. And in this sense, it's good, because now we have a whole new group of people that can join the resistance. People who are a bit like less radical or less engaged in militant work. There's a big wave of people who are just joining hardcore resistance movements. So this is a good thing. But on the other hand, what is he actually going to do? He wants to, okay, so we're already not really granting land to indigenous and Quilombo people. I'm not sure. Do you know what Quilombo? Should I explain?
Yeah, Quilombo? I would actually wanted to ask that question. I had a just glance at what that was, but I would love if you could explain who these people are. Yeah.
Yeah, so we have indigenous communities, and we have laws that protect their right to land. And then we have Quilombo people who are basically the same, but of the African diaspora. So they are the formerly the enslaved people from the beginning of colonization that ran away. They used to run away from the farms and form these communities, these resistance communities, and they're very powerful. And they interact with indigenous peoples, because when these Africans, these enslaved Africans, ran away, they would meet up with indigenous peoples and they would come together and form communities and they would exchange a lot. So there was a little bit of a cultural exchange there. And it's a very unique, it's very unique to Brazil, this interaction and the way it happened in resistance against the Christian colonial white European thing. So we talk a lot about in connection the two things, because now they talk a lot about how to unite the forces. Yesterday at this table, there were leaders from Quilombos as well, and they talk about uniting forces politically and spiritually, because they have their own spiritual practices that complement each other. And they also fight for land, for having the right to land, because they have a lot of spiritual practices that depend on rivers, that depend on nature, that depend on the land, the ancestral lands. And agribusiness, for example, kills all of that. These communities are being put in a corner, and they're granted maybe an inch of land, and then everything around is so fucked up that their land is impossible to live on. For example, a river, you have a little piece of river, but the river is being polluted up there. So the whole river is messed up, and then kids can't even swim there anymore. So we have indigenous and Columbus peoples paying for crimes they didn't commit for years and years after the crime is committed, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah. The process of decolonizing Brazil or the land, right, is a long struggle. I think that the it has taken different shapes and forms, and now we think that we're a very progressive society, and that we've kind of gotten rid of a lot of these colonial, I guess, ambitions or colonial elements of our culture or society. But it's very obvious that they still very much exist, just in different forms. Yeah. And you know, something you say is really interesting is, yeah, they'll grant them a piece of land, but like the land or the ecosystem, the rivers, they don't fit within that border. So
they don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but they fight for the land in a context where they already ask for less than their right. Mm-hmm. What the real fear now is not that he will no longer grant an inch, a centimeter, we say here.
Yeah.
We're not even going to grant that anymore. The fear now is that it could actually be worse. Not just not granting anymore, actually revoking the ones that have already been granted.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the extreme thing that maybe would have not happened with Haddad if the other man had won. So if Haddad won, maybe some of the people who already were granted land could keep their land. Now, if this dude actually takes away land from people who already got it, you know, they already have the paperwork, which is so hard. It's decades and decades of work to get very, very small thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If he takes that away, can you imagine to the people who didn't even get their process heard yet? We're talking about many, many tribes, communities that are fighting to be recognized. And if you're already taking away the recognition of the few who are already granted recognition, I mean, it's next level absurdity.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I know and it is.
I don't know even what to say about this. I get emotional because even PT, right, the Workers' Party, the other guy, Haddad, even they did a lot of shitty things. I mean, the whole discussion is they are also capitalists. It's kind of pathetic that they accuse each other. This polarization between Bolsonaro and Haddad was so polarized. PT and basically not PT, the Workers' Party. Is people hate the Workers' Party so much that this polarization basically became like capitalists and communists, which is ridiculous because they're both extremely capitalist. PT is just they want to improve the capitalist system by just giving a little bit of crumbs here and there and sustaining the poorest population and helping the poorest enter the capitalist system.
Mm-hmm.
And helping these indigenous people or Colombo people enter the university or the workforce and teaching them the ways of the West. This is what we're doing. So basically the other one is trying to just kill them and the other one is trying to teach them the ways of the West.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's better than dying, right? But it is a death. But it is also a death. You know, you have to see that this is also death because it's epistemic death or something.
Right.
It's death of a culture, death of rituals, of a language. I mean, rituals and mm-hmm. and culture and literal languages, words, knowledge is dead. They are dead.
Right. Yeah, that is what's at stake. And it's like asking, well, these are important differences between being killed, obviously, and having land taken away, and trying to incorporate indigenous people into a Western way of living or thinking. Those are obviously very different because one is death and one is life, but with a lot of things attached to it.
Yeah.
But I feel like like when Trump was elected here, and I know that we can't compare the two, but, you know, this sort of resurgence of right-wing populism around the world, seeing that, it was depressing, but it was also, maybe I had this sort of thought, like, maybe this will get people to kind of wake up to what the nature of the system really is, that Trump isn't a anomaly. He's exactly what you would expect in a time like this. And when so-called liberals or more leftists that as they're represented in American politics, which of course they're very conservative and right wing, but they're considered, you know, leftists, Democrats, this whole idea that, like, we'll just keep on coasting along in this sort of comfortable delusion that, you know, America isn't founded on all of these horrible ideas and premises. And that maybe if by electing somebody who so blatantly believes these things and espouses these horrendous points of view, that people might actually wake up to the real nature of it, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be the case at all. It seems like not only is Trump gaining popularity here, I don't actually see that there's anything that the Democratic Party can do to sort of stop that. And I imagine the same, except to maybe a much more extreme degree, is going on in Brazil, where people are like, we need to stop this man from getting elected because the outcome would be so terrible, but without actually reflecting on what is already taking place and that the ground has already been set by all of their candidates that they may have thought were great, right? And mm-hmm. it's sort of what I want, and what I've really started to ask people is that the crises that we're in, both political, ecological, you know, the climate, whatever angle you take, is so deep that really electoral politics is not even going to get anywhere close to addressing those things. And it's going to require something much more. It's going to be very difficult, of course. It's not going to be an easy process by any means, and it's extremely dangerous. But it's going to require so much more of us than going to the polls every few years. Kind of my point of view on that.
Yeah, the thing about democracy, right? This is democracy. Why I don't vote? I mean, this isn't democracy not working well. We're in the situation because democracy is working. This is what democracy looks like, unfortunately. At least in the world we live in now. I mean, if I, you know, to vote, I'm strengthening the system. I want to have a voice. I'm validating a system that isn't valid. It's not, I don't want to participate in it because this guy won because democracy, this is what our democracy looks like. This mentality didn't come to be because of him. You know, he's not the one influencing people's minds. He's a symptom of what people already think. So in a way, this is, like Trump, it's definitely parallels here. We can definitely compare. I mean, don't they even say that Steve Bannon helped Bolsonaro? I don't know. There's a whole relationship between this stuff, because what this man, this elected man, represents is Brazil's true desire to live up to American, to North American standards or the United States standards. We want to be seen as more Northern and Western. And we feel like being more like you guys, will make us better, you know, like, will make us better. We'll be superior racially, culturally, economically. We want to, we mimic the West. And this guy, this is what this guy represents. This is something that's been happening in Brazil since Brazil is Brazil. We've been dealing with this. So we kind of suppress everyone who doesn't fit into this norm, this Western norm, because we're ashamed of them. I have this in my family. I mean, from the microcosm, I have indigenous people in my past, women. I have one woman in my family. And they're not just men. We don't talk about indigenous men, you know, like, oh, yeah, I had an indigenous grandfather. No, they're women. I'm going to use this word. I'm sorry. Can I? These women were raped. They were indigenous women. We don't talk about indigenous men in our families. We talk about women, women that were raped by white men. And we are ashamed of the women. We pretend we're not indigenous. No, we've converted. We're Christian now. There was a time when we were forced to take on Portuguese names. The practice, so, I mean, I can say I have indigenous background, but I have been whitewashed. My family for generations has been Christianized and whitewashed, and we are ashamed. So this is not new. You know, we are ashamed of indigenous Colombo and everything that is in Western. So, of course, people are voting for this guy, and people want this guy to be our leader because he brings us closer to something else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That isn't us. We have an inferiority complex or something.
Yeah, I remember it was last year I had a conversation with, he's a writer named Bayo Akamolafe, and he is Nigerian, but he was, something he talked about is, I think he wrote an essay called like Healing from Whiteness or something. No, it wasn't that. It was something like that, because I interviewed another guy who wrote something about that. But he has written a lot about kind of getting over overcoming your, quote, whiteness. And he is a he's a Nigerian man. And we discussed this. Like, he said, well, in Nigeria, we compare our education systems, we compare our culture, we compare everything to Western values. And as a result, of course, whiteness and being white in a lot of ways is just a construct. It has less to do with color of your skin, although, of course, that plays a part. But it's in great part, it's just it's privilege, and it's a certain way of living and being perceived in the world. And it was really fascinating to hear that, because I think I was just starting to come into this awareness of what that was and how people who are in completely different parts of the world compare themselves to American or Western values. And to hear you talk about that in Brazil, you know, I think looking through the Brazilian election through primarily English speaking or English written articles written either by American publications or maybe a British publication like The Guardian, you don't get necessarily the indigenous perspective, although they may write about that. You don't get the perspective of people and what it is like to be Brazilian and the social complexity of being a Brazilian, and how, as you've written about, the complexity of the identity of an indigenous person or a person who is a I'm going to say that incorrectly.
Quilombo.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Imagine the Q U is a K. Quilombo.
Quilombo. Okay.
Yeah.
And those people, of course, and having to reconcile with this Christianization, this colonization that happened, you know, for centuries, and that these elements still exist within Brazilian society. Maybe I'll ask, like, in the Brazilian experience, what role does whiteness play in Brazilian culture? I mean, is there this sort of like this hierarchy of like the whiteness is more desirable, or being more Western is more desirable versus being indigenous or anything like that? Like, what is the experience with that?
It's really complicated. I write about this almost spiritually, because, like you said, the media is Western as a whole. And when we talk about politics, we talk about politics as we perceive it in Western context. We don't talk about all of the philosophical, personal, the aspect of identity. And we try to also remove ourselves, right? It's academic practice to just remove ourselves and be objective. Instead of talking about me, I talk about how I feel, I talk about my personal experience, and I know I'm not alone. I can talk about myself, you know. I talk about my personal experience, and this should strengthen my work, not weaken it. If people say, I'm not being objective because, I'm just talking about myself, that doesn't necessarily mean it's everyone. I'm not alone, you know. What I go through and what people go through individually, we're together. Of course, there are differences, but there are patterns as well with what we experience. So it's important to talk about that. I can say how we deal with whiteness from my own perspective, how my family deals with whiteness, and I know I'm not alone on this. But we also see as a whole. So I'm not going to remove myself. Brazil has been trying to pretend to be white for a really long time. We have been, this whole thing about Brazilian women being beautiful, I also wrote about this. Brazilian women being sexy, this thing, sexy Brazilian women, was a manufactured thing. It was a racial cleansing to clean, like to get rid of Africanoid exaggerations of the female body. So the miscegenation in our history has also been a type of genocide. White men assaulted women of color here as a way to turn our population more white, as if it was, you know, you're welcome. It was right. A favor, right. You know? So we have this very, you know, if we talk about a practice of 500 years, we can't, I mean, even if you're not spiritual, if you don't practice, you can't expect psychologically and culturally for something that happens for 500 years to just in 10 years change, you know, or to go away. It's so in our heads. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we want to be white. It's that we try to perceive all the non-white things about us as something tamed by our own whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if this makes sense.
That does make sense, I think, yeah.
I'm gonna explain for the example. I also wrote an article about the museum when it burned down.
Mm.
Remember?
Yes, yeah.
Crisis, crying, everyone freaking out. Oh my God, this is horrible. Horrific. I've never seen Brazil so upset about a burning building. I mean, shit burns here all the time, you know, like, people die and houses burn down all the time. That was commotion. No one is upset. Like, people are not motivated when they see criminal fires at indigenous communities, which happens often. To kick out an indigenous community from their private land, right? Because indigenous people don't believe land should be owned. They want land, but they don't want to own land. You know, so they already deal with land in a different way. So people who think that they have the right to own the land on which indigenous people live, it's common practice to set fire. People in, people out, whatever, it doesn't matter, set fire. So this happened not far from where the museum is. People are not upset. To this day, people around Rio say, oh, but indigenous people, they occupy land, you know, they're opportunistic. They do it because they want it for the money. They want the land because somehow it has financial value. And so there is this idea of opportunism. And they don't see the indigenous people that are alive here now as having history. Why? Because of, I don't know, some racist asshole from Europe in the 18th, like Hegel. Like, Africans don't have history. Indigenous people don't have history. Why? Because when they came here, they saw indigenous people as not having a king, not having faith, and by faith meaning in Christianity, right? So this makes them less human. They don't have history, they don't have a king, they don't have faith in Christianity. So they're practically what, animals. You can hunt them down like an animal. And to this day, we see indigenous people that way. And then everyone tells me, but there are so many indigenous languages there in books. In the National Museum, all of these indigenous languages preserved there in books. And that's all gone. You know, that's so sad. Yeah, it's sad. But what's more sad is that we have to preserve them in books in a museum that's practically abandoned for decades, instead of actually listening to the indigenous peoples alive now, trying to preserve these languages now. So we value our indigenous culture and our indigenous heritage. We do. But within whiteness, within the confinement of our established whiteness. When indigenous people are preserved in a white museum, it's okay. But the indigenous people alive here now who reject whiteness, no, that's not okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always strange when the value of an indigenous culture is placed because it's been documented, because there are books and records showing this is their cultural knowledge, this is the languages they spoke. We have all of that written down, so we're good. Without actually recognizing that though this is people that are practicing this, that this is a part of their being. And yeah, that sort of hypocrisy or that blatant...
I get emotional talking about this. It makes me very angry.
Oh, yeah. No, I can understand that. And like for me, living in the U.S., it's like indigenous people really don't have... They're very... they're excluded, I should say, for the most part, from politics, from... you know, people don't really consider or take into account, you know, what, say, a First Nation would say on any matter. I think it really surprised people when Standing Rock, when there was that protest saying, you know, we don't want this pipeline built and we're going to put our bodies in the way of it. People get very entitled and say, you know, that's not for them to decide. That's not their land. It's not this or that. But we're talking about a completely different set of values, and that clash between those different values of the dominant culture and the indigenous culture, there's always going to be that clash. And the fact that people, even when they're small in numbers, are willing to stand up against an oppressive culture, an oppressive state, and do it, I think it just throws a wrench in people's understanding of why people do what they do. You know, like you said, they want the land because it'll get them money or there's some financial incentive, right? Without realizing that, like, no, that's just, they don't see themselves, or less so than maybe us, they don't see themselves as being separate from the land or the forest. That's always mm-hmm. been a part of who they are as a people. They've never felt like they were separated from it. And so fighting for that is like fighting for their lives. And also, I want to point to... you know, this, I think what really freaked me out is I, you know, I talk a lot about like climate change. I talk a lot about ecological issues on this podcast, and, you know, Brazil has still very large, I mean, forests. And I know, imagine that a lot of it's been chopped up at this point or sectioned, for various
burned.
Right. Yeah. But this individual who was just elected is promising to like sell all that off so it can be, you know, make way for agribusiness, for logging, for mining, or whatever it is. And it's the indigenous people that are always fighting on behalf of the land to protect it so that it's actually for all of us. It's not just for them. Maybe that's, I don't know how they view it because I can't speak on their behalf. But the fact that they're like, these are the lungs of the world. This forest is integral to maintaining a healthy planet. And if we have a fascist leader in Brazil who's willing to sell that all off and really just say, chop it all up and we'll make some money off of it, is terrible for not just Brazil and not just for the indigenous people, but for everybody in the world. And that's, I think, why people are like, oh, shit. Like, what's happening down there, guys? Yeah. Like, I know there's a lot of shit going on down there, but what the fuck are you doing? Like, this is bad, you know? That's what it seems like. I think people are like, uh-oh. Like,
left to not cry, right? Yeah, I know. You feel like, I totally feel you.
It's disturbing.
So it's people, I'm like I told you, it's affecting people's mental health. We are freaking out. People are freaking out here. I don't know. I don't know if it like comes through in the articles people read online. I don't know. But the atmosphere on the streets and people, we are fucking stressed, man. We don't know what to do. For example, when you're talking about climate change, what he wants to do as well, the dude, is to pull us out of the Paris deal, right?
Right.
Like Trump, right. Of course. Mm-hmm. He's just following the lead. And what this means for us, like you said, we have already been burning down the Amazon forest for a really long time. The biggest fire in the history of humanity was one to just make, how do you say, pasto, where the cows hang out, you know? I don't forgot the word, sorry.
Like pastures,
The pasture.
Yeah.
There was a fire, like, you know, a massive, massive fire that you can see from space, kind of fire.
Yeah.
To make pasture for cows. We are the biggest meat, we have a huge meat industry. Cow and soy to feed the cows and stuff like that. And that's what they always say, agribusiness is a good thing. There was an ad on TV here, our main news, blah, 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 where they say agro is pop. It's hip. It's like a new way of doing things. The modernity, it's development. It's progress. We have the word progress on our flag, you know? And this is it's such a scary concept because of exactly what you're saying. It's not just, I mean, if you think about it, Brazil has the Amazon forest, large part of it. We are a huge country. We're huge, huge. It's bizarre to me that having all of these natural resources, having all of what we have, we somehow can't be self-sufficient. We don't want, right? Because there was something else that we need to be self-sufficient nowadays, the military. For a country, for a nation. This is why I'm an anarchist. For what is the concept of a state, you know? It's not the well-being of our people as a community and sustaining ourselves. It's having a badass army. We need the United States to have a badass army. I recorded that video as well in the panic of the moment. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, I did. I did, yes.
I was like, I drank 2 glasses of wine and I was like freaking out a little bit. And I recorded it because it was the first round of elections. The dude was almost winning on the first round, so we almost didn't even have a second round. And I made that video basically because it was scary. Not that, he might win or the elections and everything, but that this just means we need an army. The place where I recorded the video was so militarized because the guy is from Rio. I'm from Niterói. I'm from the region where he is from. And Brazil is very big. As I recorded that video, I was in the place where he is from, where he's been a politician for a very long time before he became president. And it's insanely militarized. We're talking about you're in traffic and you see AK-47 sticking out of military trucks everywhere. There is a huge military ship in the Bahia de Guanabara, in the bay between Rio and Niterói, my hometown. Massive, massive ship with the ones that receive several helicopters type of thing. And we've always been militarized. You know, we have military police. We've always been at war with ourselves. With our poor people. But this next level of militarization, this guy's. So we don't aim to be self-sufficient in the sense that we have resources. We mean to be self-sufficient in a military sense. And that's why we need the United States. Mm-hmm. And this is what this guy presents.
Okay.
And it breaks my heart.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is. And you mentioned there was that woman that was beaten up by, I think it was the military police the day of the election. Is that right? There was a woman that was beaten by police. Is that right?
Military police, like,
yeah.
I said.
Yep.
Hurting our own people.
Right.
The military is not at war with anyone else but ourselves.
Yeah. And so, of course, here in the United States, this whole thing with the past couple of weeks, we've had a kind of uptick, I guess you could say, of right-wing violence, right? There was that guy that was sending pipe bombs out to various people he perceived as being a threat to Western, yeah. You know, like George Soros and Bill and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, all these types, right? There was a shooting. There were several other things that I'm... I had an interview with a guy. We talked about the Proud Boys and their attack on in New York City after their founder spoke at a Republican club. And so there just seems to be in the United States, since Trump was elected, this sort of empowerment of these groups. They feel a little more comfortable using the rhetoric they feel like they want to use. Do you feel like with this individual who was elected in Brazil that because of his campaign and the things that he has said, and now that he is actually going to be president in January, that there's going to be a rise, or there already has been a rise of violence, not only by the police, but by other elements of Brazilian society as well?
Oh, man. Look, the night of the first round of elections, it was October 7th, the first round of elections. After midnight, that dawn, so technically October 8th, a man was killed already because he announced, "I'm going to cry."
I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I say the words and then I get emotional.
I understand.
So yeah. It was already the first night of the first round. The guy didn't even win yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he announced at a bar that he voted Haddad. And he was stabbed 13 times. The citizen that attacked him actually got into a fight with him at a bar, interfered with a fight he was having with his friends. He was talking to his friends at a bar. The individual enters a conversation to defend the elected dude, goes home, picks up a knife, comes back to the bar, and attacks him. You know, this, I'm sorry if it's really graphic, but I want to make clear, you know, that he was technically the first victim only a few hours after the first round of elections. There is a documentary about him already. His name was Moa, and he was from Salvador, the city where I live, and I know the people who made the documentary. They made it very, very fast, so it came out a few days before the second round of elections, so they tried to make it very fast. It was done very in the heat of the moment, and I have just put English subtitles to this documentary, and it's on YouTube, so if anyone wants to watch. Putting the subtitles in this movie, I already cried.
Yeah.
I cried the whole time. And because he wasn't just, it was more than just an individual who died. He was also an incredibly important figure in Afro-Brazilian culture. He was a capoeira master. He was a composer. He basically kickstarted a whole musical genre of the Afro-descendants here in Bahia and in Brazil and in the world. The dude, you know, Moa wasn't just, he's such a symbol, you know, he wasn't just someone who was killed in the first victim. He represents so much of what is being actually destroyed in this country, you know. And if any, I don't want to get into too many details now, but if you can watch the movie, it's really beautiful and it's going to be in English soon. The subtitles are ready as of yesterday.
Yeah, well, if you could send me the link after this conversation, I would be happy to share it with the episode. Yeah.
Yeah, great. I'll send you the link. Yes, there is violence. There is always violence, you know, but this is a new type of barbaric scenario, I think. The hate and how it provokes, it validates horrible thoughts and ideas, and it provokes people to react on them like this, because he is a violent rhetoric, you know, he speaks so violently. He has defended dictatorship, he has defended torture, has defended murder. He talks about killing poor people constantly, killing. He wants to put guns in people's hands so they can just kill poor people. or people who try to rob them, you know. So he incites violence on the streets. My friend and I were afraid of coming out of the house. So when this girl was attacked on the streets here in Salvador, consider that, okay, the individual elected is from Rio. In the southeast of Brazil, is richer and whiter, and they all vote for him, large majority, 60% or more voted for him. I am in the northeast of Brazil. Brazil is very big. So consider that the northeast of Brazil is more rural, less white, less rich. It's not like the Rio São Paulo thing with all the tourism and the Western flow of culture and tourists. It's roots, you know, it's roots stuff. And the Northeast voted, you know, I'm in the city where Bolsonaro won nowhere. He won nowhere. Over 70% of people in the state where I live voted against him. So even here, where technically he lost here where I am, he lost here. And still, there was that type of violence by the military police. So it's hard to imagine what's going to happen in January, but the violence is already here. Imagine the violence against LGBTQ people already every day in Brazil up to this point. Now it's just worse because, you know, the dude says that when queer gay people die, when trans people die, they die because not because they are LGBTQ. They die because they are drug addicts. They work on the streets. They are this and they're that. This is the mentality that they're reproducing, you know? And it's only going to get worse. It was already getting worse. It was already horrifying, you know?
Yeah. Well, so I know that he's going to be sworn in as president in January. How long are presidential terms in Brazil?
It'd be 4 years.
4 years, yeah.
4 years of this.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I guess to ask another question is like the political situation in Brazil was always, I never really followed it very closely until more recently, I have to admit, but always hearing about there was this like corruption scandal a few years ago, and there was a popular president that had, I guess, was imprisoned for apparently trumped up corruption charges. And a lot of what's happening now is kind of like the fallout of that event. What exactly, I guess to ask this as a real question is like, what was the context of this whole thing? Like what led to, I know that there's a lot of social elements in what mm-hmm. the culture and the economically, like what Brazilians are feeling to lead to this type of thing. But there was a lot of shit going on the kind of behind the scenes that had nothing to do with that. It was a lot of political corruption. And so I want to, I guess, ask like what led to this possibility of someone like him getting elected?
You mean Lula?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Lula. Yeah, this is a whole thing. There was Lava Jato. There's also a movie about this, a horrible movie. It looks like, you know, that TV show 24.
Yeah.
You know, that's like very tense suspense, yeah. Phone calls. And There was a movie about Lava Jato like this, you know, doing the investigation and, you know, finding out who did what contract was signed, what money. It's a whole thing. I don't understand all of it, but the idea behind it is that we have Petrobras, which is the biggest oil company. We have a lot of oil. We have a lot of resources in this company. So there's a lot of corruption on contracts of construction projects, very massive, massive construction projects. So what was uncovered was that there was a whole corruption scheme around how these construction companies and how the government was financing certain construction projects. Superfatura, to like make it way more expensive than it had to be, to have a monopoly on the work. They just they could set whatever price they wanted because there was no competition, because the different types of companies competing for the same job were actually just in agreement with each other. And this had direct relationship with politicians of all parties. I want to say that basically all of it, all of political parties, all governments was involved in this corruption scheme. It was massive, billions and billions of yes, of dollars. I mean, we're talking about, I don't think I can explain the magnitude of this corruption scheme, but basically it led Lula to be arrested. So even though all political parties were involved in this at some point, it just became the way politics happened in Brazil, the way the government functioned in all types of all forms. He was implicated in it, and the fact that PT, his party, the Workers' Party, was involved in it was really disappointing to a lot of people, because they've always run on a campaign of fighting this kind of corruption. So it was particularly heartbreaking for people to be confronted with the idea that this party was also involved in something that all of these other parties were involved in. So this figure of Lula that was cherished for a lot of people, it was hard for people to believe it. So that he was actually, in fact, a part of this scheme, or he was just framed. So the discussion now here, it's really tense, was he had to be a part of it because he had no option, because this is how it was all operating. So even though he did become a part of it, he did a lot of good also. So we can't just throw him out because he did huge things for Brazil. He helped a lot of people. He did some programs. They claim that he saved a lot of lives because he did programs to help the poorest families with some money. He helped people get into universities, marginalized peoples, black people, with affirmative action. He did do a lot of social projects. And people think that this, in order to do this, he had to participate in other, you know, aspects that were more corrupt and problematic. So some people say, yes, maybe he did it, but he had to do all the other good stuff. Some people say, no, he didn't do it. He was framed. This is all a lie. That's a lot of people say that. And a lot of people say, no, fuck him. He's as bad as everyone else. We need something else completely. So this has divided the left a lot. He was arrested. He did two turns, and then Dilma went after, kind of representing him for two terms. And then she was taken out of office. A lot of people claiming because she is not corrupt, surprisingly, but some people believe that she was impeached because she was opposing corruption schemes. There is, you know, recordings, there's evidence of people, you know, planning to get her out in order to continue doing their, you know, their business in there. So even this party, which is not very radical, they are capitalist, they do social programs, they're kind of social democratic. Even they are too radical for these people, and they have to be, you know, put down, basically. And Lula being put in prison, the way he did and when he was put in prison, is certainly a way to bar him from actually being elected. He would have won, probably. He would have won over Bolsonaro. There's little question. But then when he's arrested and they incite the population to hate his party, he presents wasteful. Half of the people pretty much compare him to Gandhi and Mandela, and the other people just hate him. So this polarization was strategic in order to get this dude elected. Because when he had to put Fernando Haddad in his place as presidential candidate, very few people knew who he was. He did some good stuff. He was an education minister for some years, and he is an educator. Sound politician. married, attractive, you know, he was, you know, a politician in a proper way. But people didn't really know him so much. And he ran a whole campaign of an image of being interchangeable with Lula. So because they knew Lula was so popular and were to win, the first round, they basically divided the left into two sections. The people from PSOL and the Communist Party, and the other, which is from him, the more socialist. You know, so the left got divided while the right was united against this dude. And that was considered a bit of an unfortunate decision strategically. So by the time he started to invest on the image of Fernando Haddad, it was already the second round of elections, and it was a little bit too late. Because before that, they were just banking on Lula, Lula, Lula. He's Lula, he's Lula, but he's not. He's Haddad, you know, he's Fernando Haddad. Who is this man? And his image wasn't properly developed until too late.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you for going over that, getting me up to speed on that. It just seemed like so complicated, and I'm like, I don't know if I want to invest hours of energy trying to unpack like what the hell is going on in Brazil. But I acknowledge how important it is to understand, because I mean, Brazil isn't just Brazil. It's a part of it affects everybody in South America, everybody in the world. I mean, Brazil is a big thing for so many people. So I think laying out like what really happened and understanding, also learning lessons about how you said the left was split. That seems to be the case almost everywhere, where the leftists are fighting over certain things while the right wing is organizing and getting stronger and building a base and moving forward. And I see this over and over again. I just watched a documentary about Roe v. Wade, right? That the decision, Supreme Court in the United States to legalize abortion, and how really actually for a while abortion wasn't as politicized as it is now in the United States, and Republicans like people we consider to be very conservative, like Reagan and several others that were mentioned in this documentary, actually signed pretty progressive bills and were in kind of ambivalent or supportive of rights for women to have abortions. And then the Christian right, the like evangelical right wing in the United States, realized that they wouldn't get anywhere unless they really started investing a lot of their energy into politics. And that happened like decades ago. So the far right, I would say, the Christian right in the United States has been working for decades trying to create a theocratic state here in the U.S., and they're getting closer and closer to that. I mean, we have a vice president who is openly in favor of a lot of these things. He himself is a very right-wing Christian, and while Trump isn't Christian, he kind of opens the door for these groups to have more power, and I think people kind of forget that when they talk about impeaching Trump. Like, if we get Trump out of here, it'll be fine. And I'm like, well, we have Mike Pence who will step into place, and who knows what horrible... Like, he's a real politician, which I mean in the worst sense. He understands how to appeal to different sides and to speak in a way that's a little more... you know, the meanings are shrouded a little more, a little better than what Trump would do. But Trump is a very useful tool in their operation. And so I guess to sort of parallel that with maybe what's in Brazil is that while the left is fragmented and fighting amongst themselves about what to do, the right wing is making all of these gains. And I've been trying to kind of point to that a little more in more recent episodes, because I've been seeing this trend. I think a lot of people have, and it's quite frightening because people's lives are on the line. This isn't a theoretical thing anymore. This is reality. This is what we're experiencing right now. And that's just my main point. Yeah.
I don't know the solution for this polarization, this division on the left. It seems to be, in a way, necessary. I'm not sure how this is doesn't happen more on the right, but there was some effort into supporting each other. There is an effort now to unite forces, for sure. Quilombo, indigenous, queer people, LGBTQ. There is an effort to unite the left, yes. And this, hopefully, the good thing that could come out of the situation is to unite us, you know? Yesterday was really difficult because, for example, at this conference, a trans woman asked a question and an indigenous leader, a man, misused the pronoun. So it's a practice now that we try to, you know, coexist more with each other and support each other. So it's a learning process for everyone, and we're coming closer. It's not easy. It's not easy, but it's necessary now more than ever.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, and I'm speaking as somebody who, I'm a white male, cisgendered male in the United States. I acknowledge that I haven't had to deal with being misgendered. I don't have to deal with any of that anxiety that comes with being a trans person or a person who doesn't fit within a kind of binary gender, right? And, you know, trying to find common ground, I recognize the amount of patience and actually tolerance, I would even say, because it kind of goes the other way. A lot of times it's like, you white people need to be more tolerant of this and this. Well, it kind of goes the other way, where if LGBTQ people want to be like in partnership with, say, like you're mentioning, the indigenous people, and you get misgendered, not out of malice or out of rude, they're not trying to, it's just sort of a cultural or something kind of isn't, you know, it isn't communicated. So there has to be that kind of understanding, like we're in different we're not in completely different realms, but we need to kind of find a common understanding and language and not take immediate offense to anybody who doesn't understand the words that I prefer to be used, right? I think there has to be a little bit of give on both ends while also being understanding and respectful of each other's positions. Yeah.
That's basically what's happening now. I think we're making an extra effort to do exactly that. It's not easy, but just, and it's something that can be easily fixed, I guess, or worked on just by coexisting a little more, interacting more, right? You can tell that indigenous leader just hasn't been around enough trans people. It's a thing. But it doesn't come naturally to us. The subdivisions on the leftist parties were done very, in a really stupid way, because Lula was himself supporting leaders from the other Chapa. They're like blocks, you know. A few parties come together in blocks. So PT was with one communist party, and PSOL was with another communist party. You even have two different communist parties, one which is like a little more communist than the other one, a little less communist. they divide themselves a little bit. It's a whole thing, you know? Mm-hmm. But we are trying. I think now the Not Him campaign really did a lot for this, for this unification. Basically, we don't care who you vote for as soon as you don't vote for him. it was really effective. United people. Very effective.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the trouble is, okay, let's say that this unification happens and different leftist groups come together and have a common goal, which may be actually, I don't mean this in like a negative way. I don't mean that as to say it's a negative thing, but I mean it more like, do not vote for this person and we're on the same page. Not let's do this action together and make a step forward. Instead, they're saying, let's not take this wrong step, but they'll still kind of stay where we're at, you know, before that. So it seems like that's the real struggle, is trying to get a common goal and then working towards that common goal together and not undercut each other or betray each other in that process. And also there's this other thing where if you like say like how you're like, I don't vote, or you can't vote actually based on the way the laws work in Brazil. But, you know, if you're a principled anarchist and you're like, I don't believe in voting, and then you have somebody mm-hmm. who does, but they kind of have similar beliefs, but they're just very, very different ideas. One person will be like, I can't believe you're not voting. And then I was like, well, you're a fucking idiot for voting. What's wrong with, why are you buying into this bullshit system? You know, that it's like, even that creates divisions. And it's so like, I don't know what to do about it. Like, cause I don't think there's an easy solution. I think almost what my perspective has been is sort of to take a bigger point of view of like understanding that we're in the midst of a collapse scenario regarding capitalism and the system, and that we need to start building structures that exist outside of those structures, because we just need to have a basic fundamental understanding of the global trends. And while that doesn't change the fact that certain decisions on the local level are important, because they are, but also having this awareness that like, don't bank on the system to fix it. There's no way that it can. It's not built that way. This whole notion that we can fix the system when the system itself was designed to act in this way. Like you said earlier about democracy, you know, democracy allowed for this guy to get elected in the first place. And people would say, well, that's just because of all these other reasons and the system's fine. It's just, but like, I don't know, maybe there's something fundamentally wrong with having a large society like this, where you have one person or one government controlling so many different people in so many different locales. You know, that itself is a problem, and we need to start moving away from that. And that's a whole other conversation. And trying to get more and more people on board with that understanding will lead more people away from this idea that voting is going to do anything significant for them.
So what is this other things, you know, what are these other things that people speak of when they say, you know, democracy is fine, these other things are the problem, right?
Yeah.
I was at a meeting, you know, and people started to really freak out that he might win. We had a meeting that kind of gathered people from all over the city. So there are all types, political parties, anarchists and stuff. And one of my friends, actually, we're dividing, planning things and dividing into groups and strategizing. And one of my friends just cut everyone off. She's like, I think we should divide the people who do campaigning for Haddad and the people who do the other stuff. So I'm like, but why? He said, because I'm an anarchist and I want to do campaigning for any politician. And it was this, we were all there together. We were all there, you know, it was very united, but we set our boundaries, you know? Mm-hmm. And this worked really well. I mean, there was a little bit of bickering, but it's not, it wasn't a deal breaker.
Right.
That's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. So we just announced our boundaries, like, I don't want to do campaigning for a politician. I want to do some other stuff, but we're here together and we're doing stuff and we're planning together, you know, it's nice. And that was really good. And what are these things that we were fighting against? Like, I was there and my group, I formed a group, so we all divided into groups and we're strategizing. My strategy group was how to deal with the fake news thing, because this is what everyone says. The problem is not democracy, it's how we've been applying it. It's like, okay, how have we been applying democracy wrong, right? We have the media, and everyone is freaking out about this media issue and the fake news issue, because it's definitely been influencing people's minds. But people are already predisposed to believe the lies that they read online, you know. So they already have ideas and they just are feeding on it. So we are just constantly being bombarded with information that doesn't really make us more well-informed or wiser at all. It's just we're stuffing our heads with useless information. It's just making us anxious, angry, freaked out. And this is WhatsApp. People, WhatsApp groups, and forwarding images, videos, texts without reference, very insightful, like hateful things, angry things, it's sensational things. And we formed a group on, I talked about, and I did a little class, a small group, a course on media literacy, how to not only interpret information we are consuming so much, to consume less, first of all. And when we consume media, if we're going to consume media consciously, we need to consume less of it, because there's no way we're going to consume as much as we've been consuming and be critical of all of it at the same time, you know?
Right.
So we also end up just consuming less of the thread thing, less of the WhatsApp forwarding thing, and just being more thorough about the information we do choose to absorb. And also, we talked about how to create media consciously. So we not only consume, we can also, when we forward this kind of shit, we are also producing media. And this is not something only from the right. This is something the left does really well as well. The left does the fake news thing also. So we talked about what our responsibility is to not only be more thorough with what we absorb, be more conscious of what we share because of what we produce, the kind of media we produce by sharing or by actually creating. And we could create media as well, but we have to think about how to create, citing or what kind of information, how we are sharing information and for what purpose, right? And what our values, because we have to think about what our values are, because our values actually dictate what we are exposed to. We are constantly bombarded with information. My dad kept forwarding me right-wing propaganda. It was all fake and it was all sensational and inciting rage, you know, and I couldn't stand it. My relationship with my dad will never be the same, by the way, after these elections. So I know he's pretty exposed to this media, this fake news, because of who he is as an individual. I'm an individual, and I know that I'm predisposed to certain information than to others because of my values. So I need to be conscious of this. I have certain values, and I need to seek out media that shares my values. And this is why I'm so proud of being a part of Gods and Radicals. You know, we are not, it's not about being objective and talking about facts. Fake news is not about facts, you know? In a way, fake news just distracts people from the reality that media is all biased. We all have opinions. We all have a purpose. And we need to just be honest about what our values are and our purpose is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I thank you for going over that, because I've been guilty of, you know, sharing things that I'm like, I need to probably like make sure that what I said or what I'm putting out there is really valid or backed up by research or whatever, because it is based on your own worldview, my own values, what I think is important. And I think especially with social media, like the big social media companies like Facebook or Twitter or just like even like search engines like Google, is based on what they want, what they think that you believe, right? Based on your patterns, based on the data that they've accumulated on you. And we get locked into information channels, right? And you get really biased. And it's actually kind of interesting, you know, even though I talk a lot about like the rise of the far right or whatever, I remember just a couple days ago, so on my Instagram profile, I will post like my new episode, I'll say like, I'll show a picture of the title card that I make for each episode. And I put it up and I'll hashtag certain things. And normally it's just, you know, hashtag podcast, da da da. And usually it's not anything that if you're not in that, that niche, that kind of milieu or that interest, you're not going to really find it. But the most recent episode I released this week was with that guy I mentioned, his name is Spencer Sunshine, who does research on far-right groups and far-right movements. And I just put like hashtag Proud Boys, and I didn't think anything about it because I've done this 100 times, you know, just whatever. That's what this is about. So here it is. And I got all these fucking comments from these like right-wing, alt-right guys that were saying I'm just this left-wing chud and all this like weird like language that they use specifically. And it was like two worlds kind of collided. Like I'm never really exposed to that because I'm not a big name, you know. I'm not actively protesting in the streets. I haven't been doxxed, you know. I haven't had anything like that happen to me. Mm-hmm. But for just the first time, I got a tiny, tiny glimpse into what people that actually are at the forefront of these things experience pretty constantly, which is just this horrendous like harassment that's being directed towards you online. And it was really gross. Like, I felt gross. I was like,
yeah.
Ugh, like,
no, it's terrible.
Yeah. And, what it exposed me to also is I constantly forget this, that people don't have the same worldview as me, which just seems like such an obvious thing, like, no shit, but we can see it all around us all the time. I'm in the midst of that all the time, but I forget that there are people that are living in their own little fake, what we would call like fake news world, their little Trump cult, yeah. Right? Like there's a cult of personality around someone like Donald Trump, and they have their own worldview and their own facts about things. And when those collide with like, say, my worldview, it's not going to be pleasant. There's not even really a room to have a real conversation because we're so fundamentally different views of reality. So very different. Like, I think I was someone that I was talking to who was talking to their friend about why they supported Trump. And he says, well, do you know about the detention centers and how they're separating children from their families? And the guy's like, oh, I have not heard about that. And like, they just didn't know like a fundamental policy that the Trump administration had enacted. Right? Like,
have you been living under a rock?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I don't know. I don't get it. Cause I think that they like his personality or something, and they think that's it, that's enough for me. And it's so strange to me to know that people aren't aware of certain things that are happening, but
it makes sense.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
It does make sense.
These people don't they're not accessing this type of information because, like you said, the personality is enough for them. Now, what does this personality represent, right? They relate, they like, they buy this image because of their values, their core values as people. I mean, it's hard for me to accept that, you know, my family members have, you know, fascist values. It's not easy. I don't say this lightheartedly, you know. I say this, it is heartbreak. I'm not sure to what extent they actually have been manipulated into thinking what they think. These people buy into these personalities really because they believe that, for example, the solution to the crisis of capitalism is to kill the poor. They believe this. I mean, they think that these people are poor because they don't work hard enough. They believe that. So I don't want to mention my dad. He doesn't understand English, so. But for example, it's a good example. He is a person who would like to believe that everything he's achieved in life is because of him, because he fought for it, because he's intelligent, because he earns it. It's meritocracy, right? But as soon as his company goes bankrupt, that's the fault of the political party in power at that time. So he wants to take credit when he wins, but he will not take credit when he fails. It's too painful. And the meritocracy thing is a serious problem within the middle class here in Brazil, because we're all working class, but we really, really want to believe that hard. If we fight, if we deserve it, we will be fine. If we follow the rules, if you go to college, you graduate, you get a job, you have a family, you do the right thing, you'll be fine. But we are in a generation now where we know that that's not really the case. We know that it doesn't matter how hard we work and how much we follow the rules. First of all, that's already a privilege. That's already a privilege we have to follow the rules properly. We have the privilege of being cis. We have the privilege of being straight. We have the privilege of having access to university. There are so many things, you know, that lead to this actually being able to follow the rules. So I think it's a matter of value. We actually have the value that many Brazilians truly believe, that poor people are poor because they don't deserve to be more successful. They're not worthy. A lot of people think that queer people, gay people, have the choice of not being that if they really wanted to. This is a thing. That was a fake news thing, the Kichi Gay. It's a gay school kit that they were trying to, they claimed that Daji was passing around to kids at schools, basically teaching them about sexuality. I mean, this is the mentality. People really think that if you're properly trained in childhood, properly educated, maybe beaten a little, you can be straight and smart, you know? And this is a value. This is not fake news. You know, the fake news is a result of this mentality, not vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
So it's truly heartbreaking.
Yeah, heartbreaking. It is. And I think that that's sort of the thing that I've had to kind of understand about myself, is that we internalize these values, even if we intellectually don't believe them and we are working against them. We oftentimes internally hold ourselves to these standards, and trying to decondition ourselves from that internal value system that's been, you know, basically, I mean, whether or not literally or not, but beaten into us. That's really a big part of the internal struggle, I think, of being somebody who wants to bring about a different world that is better, is sort of overcoming that within themselves. And I think we all have the little, you know, fascist dictators inside ourselves that we have to kind of check. Be like, well, where did that come from? Where did that thought come from? Why did I automatically judge that person for this that they have no control over? Why am I not more compassionate or whatever, right? I think that it's important for people to have a little bit of, I think people feel really bad because they're like, I don't know why I feel the way I do or why I judge people the way I do. But I think it's important to recognize that your first thought about somebody or something doesn't necessarily represent who you are as in totality. It's what you choose to think about after that. You reflect on that first thought, and why did I feel that way in the first place? You know, where does that stem from? Have some kind of compassion for yourself. And try to work towards, you know, getting away from those values. And that'll inform your whole way of being in the world. And so we've been...
So much to deconstruct and unlearn, right?
Yeah.
All of us.
Yes, I think so.
Mm.
Well, I really appreciate the time that we've been talking for about an hour and a half. And...
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this conversation. Yeah.
Me too. It passed really fast.
Yeah. There's so many things we could, I think, unpack discussing all these things. I had a kind of a loose idea. I knew we needed to hit those big points on the recent election. And I think you did an excellent job discussing not only like on the ground politically what's happening, but also the fact that everybody's feeling something from this. I mean, there's probably a segment of the population that feels empowered by what's happening, but there's a large section of the population that is feeling very anxious and stressed about what, you know, what comes ahead for the people. And I just want to say I really thank you for writing what you've written about it and for talking about it with me.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I really...
Oh, thank you. I really
yeah.
opportunity to get this out of my chest as well.
Yeah.
It helps me process, I have to say.
Yeah.
It helped me process.
Yeah, and I
thank you very much.
Oh, of course. And I feel like I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, so having this come up and have the opportunity to talk about it was really a pleasure. So I know that you write for Gods and Radicals, and I'm just such a huge fan of Gods and Radicals, and I feel like I am... That's not like I'm piggybacking on them or on Gods and Radicals, but I love like what Gods and Radicals is on multiple levels. So I've talked with, like I mentioned, several people that work for Gods and Radicals, and I just admire what you are all doing. And I know, yeah, and I know, and I'll link people to your writing down in the description. I know that you're on Twitter as well. Is there any other places that people that you would want to maybe direct people towards regarding your work, or any other things that you want people to know about that you want people to find?
Yeah, no, thanks. No, this is it. I mean, most of my work is at Gods and Radicals. I have a lot of work here in Brazil too, but it's mostly in Brazilian Portuguese. I published a magazine, an anarchist feminist decolonial magazine here, where I've been doing some translation of Lucy Parsons to Portuguese. So I have some work here, but it's all in Portuguese. I think the stuff in English you already got.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
I also really like working for Gods and Radicals with.
Good.
We are a really great team.
Yeah. I just admire the whole thing. So, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week, and as a psychedelic bard, Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it.